Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayetze. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Vayetze. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Pasha is Parshat Vayetze. Today I would like to examine the topic of surviving in a hostile world. Unfortunately, with the events of the last week, this has become a very, very real topic. In a previous podcast, I have spoken about how Parshat Vayetze is where Yaakov comes into his own, where he begins to make his mark as the third patriarch. Today I would like to examine one element, survival. Let us begin with the end of last week's parsha. Yaakov masquerades as his brother. In doing so, he tricks his father. He quote-unquote steals the blessing. And although when his father finds out, he validates the blessing that was given to Yaakov, Esav is devastated by what happened. Esav, his brother, hates him. Esav plots to kill him. And Yaakov's mother says to him, "You must run away to my brother, because Esav is planning to kill you. I cannot lose both of you on one day." And eventually she comes up with what we would call a safe exit. She convinces Yitzchak that Yaakov must leave in order to find a wife, because Yaakov cannot marry one of the local Canaanite women. And so Yaakov is sent away by Yitzchak. And this is where our parsha begins. Yaakov leaves Beersheba to go to Haran. It doesn't say that he flees. And physically, I would imagine that he's not running away. But metaphorically, he is. He knows that his brother, sooner or later, will attempt to kill him. In the second verse in our parsha, it says, "Vayifka b'makom." Yaakov encounters a place. The word vayifka, paga, we know from modern Hebrew is the word for a terrorist incident, a pigua. It is a place of hurt, pain. Yaakov comes to a place which is very painful. Very painful because he's all alone. Very painful because he's very, very vulnerable. Very painful because Yaakov has no clue what the future holds for him. Yaakov leaves his bubble in Beersheba to now go into a reality which he knows is not welcoming. And then all of a sudden Yaakov has a dream, a prophetic vision. So I would like to begin with the first element of how does one survive. One survives by having a dream of a better reality, a dream which gives one hope, a dream which gives one the drive, the motivation to continue living. In this situation, the dream is a prophetic vision. Let us look at what is contained in that dream. The first thing is that God actually says to Yaakov, "I am the God of your father Abraham." And as God continues to say, the blessings which God promised Abraham, he is now promising Yaakov. This land will be yours. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So that God is now giving Yaakov a goal, a hope. You will have children. Your children will actualize taking possession of this land. Your children will actualize a destiny that has already been presented to Abraham at the very beginning of his relationship with God. You will become a light unto the nations. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. To survive, one needs to be able to have a goal, a hope. But there's another aspect to it. God says emphatically, "I will be with you. From beginning to end, I will never abandon you." This is a second element. The realization, I am not alone. And in this case, the realization that no matter where I am, God is with me. God is watching over me. God will not let me go by the wayside. There's a third element which appears here. And here I would like to examine a midrash which Rashi quotes. Jacob has a vision. The vision is of a ladder where God is at the top of the ladder. There are angels who are going up and down the ladder. And in the world of midrash, the rabbis are bothered by the fact, why should angels be going up and then going down? Angels are from the heaven. If anything, the angels should be going down and then going up. And there are various explanations which are offered, and as I said, I would like to examine one. Rashi says the angels who are going up are the angels who accompany Jacob in the land of Israel. The angels who are coming down are the angels who will accompany him when he leaves the land of Israel and goes to Haran. Nechama Leibowitz has a very beautiful explanation of this comment. She says that angels are the abilities, capabilities, which God equips every individual with. People need different abilities in different circumstances. What works in the land of Israel will not necessarily work outside the land of Israel. And if I now take this comment and apply it to the topic which we're looking at, people have survival instincts. People have all kinds of capacities which are latent, which all of a sudden, when they are in difficult situations, come to the fore. So that there is something which is very, very extraordinary about our human psyche, our human persona. We are constructed in such a way that we do have abilities which we could never imagine that can come out and ultimately save us in the most dire of circumstances. And it is only a matter of us drawing upon those abilities and to turn around what could be a tragic situation into a fact, a thriving situation. And we will see this more as we go along. Let's continue with what we have. In the aftermath of Jacob's dream, we read in the beginning of chapter 29 how Jacob lifts up his feet and he goes to the land of the people of the east. The imagery, lifting up your feet, is that Jacob is able to move. He's invigorated. And in fact, when we see Jacob, his first encounter with the people of Haran, I would say that Jacob is actually very, very upbeat. And in fact, unfortunately, gets a cold shower poured on him. The very first thing which Jacob says to them is, "My brethren," this is chapter 29, verse 4, "from where are you?" "We are from Haran." "Do you know Laban?" "We know him." "Is he at peace?" What can we see from Jacob? Rather than allow himself to become depressed, to become incapacitated, to become withdrawn, Jacob takes the exact opposite position. I come to a situation which is hostile. I'm going to be upbeat. I'm going to be forthcoming. I'm going to try to now seek out that which is positive. And in fact, when these people, as I said, give him the cold shoulder and then direct him to Laban's daughter, who is shepherding the sheep, Jacob immediately focuses on her. And then all of a sudden, when Jacob sees her, that is enough to energize him, to lift up this huge stone, to then go and water her sheep. Which means that sometimes it may not take that much to get somebody to overcome the hurdle of being in a difficult situation, something that you can latch onto that can give you a ray of light, hope, in what would otherwise seem a miserable situation. And look at what this brings out in Jacob. Jacob becomes Hercules. Now, of course, some people would say that, well, he sees a beautiful girl and that can be enough to really stimulate him to accomplish who knows what. Perhaps. But the point which I want to make is that if somebody comes with an attitude which is positive, then it may not take that much. And perhaps if you know how to focus, you can find that element which will bring out all of that strength within you to be able to, as I said, give a twist and give a very positive twist to the situation that you're in. Now let us fast forward a little bit. As we noted, Jacob loves Rachel. Okay, the image that you have is love at first sight. And then Jacob, in effect, negotiates for her hand. And perhaps this also is a model for us. Jacob is proactive. He doesn't wait for Laban to offer Rachel. Jacob takes the initiative. Jacob says, "Here, let me work 7 years for Rachel, your daughter, your youngest." Which means that Jacob makes the offer, an offer which Laban perhaps cannot refuse because it's so generous. Jacob also makes it perfectly clear what the terms are, what he wants. To survive, you need to be proactive. You need to have, again, very clear what is it that you want. What are you prepared to give up? Jacob knows fully well 7 years is a long time, but he's ready to do that. And in fact, the text testifies, because Jacob is so in love with Rachel, 7 years go by like a few days. And here I want to come back to what I mentioned earlier. When someone has a goal, when someone has a vision, that can help them to perhaps overcome insurmountable odds. It can lighten the burden of all the difficulties in one's path. As we know, when the time is up, and Laban tricks Jacob, and in fact gives him Leah instead of Rachel, and I won't go into the question of how did Jacob not know who it was, I leave that to your imagination. The day after, rather than becoming devastated, rather than sinking into some deep depression, Jacob still has his goal. Jacob is still determined. Jacob is still proactive. And Jacob is not going to relent until he actually gets Rachel. Perhaps I should insert, how does one survive in a hostile world? One has to be prepared to struggle. Perhaps I would say even embrace struggle. And realize that things will not be handed to you on a silver platter. One has to be prepared for setbacks. And when they happen, because they're prepared, to not fall apart, but to keep focused on their goal until they ultimately achieve it. Jacob wants to marry Rachel, and Jacob will not stop until ultimately Laban will give him Rachel. Let us now move on. And that is in chapter 30, verse 25. After Jacob has 11 sons from 4 wives, and basically feels that he has accomplished perhaps what he needed to accomplish in this place, he comes to Laban and says, "The time has come for me to go back to my land, back to my place." And he says to Laban, "You know that I have lived up to my agreement." Laban is not ready to let go of Yaakov. Laban says to him, "I know that God has blessed me because of you." And then he says to Yaakov, "You set the price. You tell me what it is that you want, and I will give it to you." And here once again, one could say, here is a setback. Yaakov wants to leave. But Yaakov realizes that perhaps the time has not yet come for him to leave. And so Yaakov takes the setback, turns it around. Here is an opportunity for me to now not only have a family, but to also create the means by which I can support them. And Yaakov comes up with a whole scheme, a whole device as to how he can ultimately make his fortune. And when we read the succeeding verses, it becomes a fascinating combination of human initiative coupled with divine assistance. Yaakov is the one who comes up with the plan, and God makes it into a reality. So that what could have been a tremendous setback, where Yaakov could have felt, here I am, stuck in this place, and in effect, slip into a state of, as I said before, despair, a feeling of enslavement. Yaakov twists the situation around, turns it on its head. And as a result of that, Yaakov emerges from the situation, becoming an extremely wealthy individual. And then we come to the next phase, where Yaakov sees his time is limited here. The sons of Laban are no longer looking at him the way they did before. Yaakov begins to feel the tension, the hostility building up. Now is the time to leave. What does Yaakov do? Which comes back to something I said earlier. Yaakov calls his wives, and he explains to them his desire, his need to have to pick up and go. And from the way the conversation goes, it seems Yaakov is not exactly sure how will his wives respond. Are they prepared to leave their father's house, to leave their family, to come with him to a foreign land? And in fact, Rachel takes the lead. And Rachel says, we have no portion in our father's house. If I come back to something I mentioned earlier, it is very, very difficult for someone to survive alone. People need a support system. Earlier I mentioned that when Yaakov has the dream, God is his support system. God says to him, no matter what, I will be with you. I will not abandon you. At this point, Yaakov also needs to have his wife, his children, to be with him, to back him. And they do. Note the fact that when Yaakov leaves, this is in chapter 31, verse 20, it says that he steals the heart of Laban in that he didn't tell him that he's running away. How does Yaakov survive? Yaakov finds an opportune moment. He runs away. And we know of many situations of where people do not confront a danger head on, but wait for that moment, that window of opportunity to run away. Yaakov does that. But as we know in this story, and I would say in many other stories, ultimately running away does not solve the problem. At some point, you have to confront it head on, especially when you have a threat which is not ready to let go. Laban pursues Yaakov. Laban eventually catches up with Yaakov. Laban too has a dream where God comes to him and says to him, back off, let Yaakov go. Laban doesn't back off so fast. Laban catches up to Yaakov, confronts him, perhaps even implicitly threatens him, accuses him, rightfully so, of stealing his gods, which Rachel had taken and hidden under the saddle of the camel. And then there comes Yaakov's moment of truth, where Yaakov will no longer run away, where Yaakov will look at Laban eye to eye, tell it as it is, make it perfectly clear that Laban can no longer have a hold on him. No matter what, he is leaving. And when Yaakov stands up to Laban, Laban backs down. They eventually make a covenant. And I would say that the essence of this covenant, this agreement, is basically live and let live. Laban will go his way. Yaakov will go his way. They agree to part ways. So what would I like to say with this? There are moments when in order to survive, perhaps one needs to run away. But running away does not eliminate evil. And if one thinks that I will constantly run, that the evil will go away, disappear, it doesn't. And there comes a point where you need to confront it. In our story, the confrontation is a verbal confrontation, which results in an understanding. As I said before, to live and let live. There may be other situations where one needs to actually fight and be prepared to fight to the death. I would like to end with how I began. To survive in a hostile world, one needs to have a vision. One needs to have a hope of a better world. That vision is what can enable someone to not only survive, but to thrive, to carry the burden, to carry the struggle. But hope is not enough. Together with the hope, one has to also have the ability to persevere in the face of setbacks, to struggle, to stand up, to fight for what you believe in, if what you believe in is just, and to not allow evil, hostile forces to set the agenda of the world. In these days, it is my hope that the free world, I would even say the rational world, the world which values life, will always have that vision, but not only the vision, but also the determination to make that vision a reality and to be prepared to struggle and to stand up for what is true, for what is moral, for what is just. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.